The Viridian Nutrition range of 200-plus award-winning products includes vitamins, minerals, herbs, nutritional oils, specialty supplements, tinctures, and balms, all formulated to be healthful, efficacious, and pure. By choosing our Viridian Nutrition range, you are one step closer to your goal of 100% wellness. Ethical vitamins with an organic heart. Available at all Browns outlets. Browns and you.
Welcome to the She Word, conversations women rarely have but really should. My name is Sasha. I'm your host for this edition of the She Word, the young women's edition, where we continue giving these conversations the attention that they deserve. Today, we are tackling a topic that's deeply personal and incredibly important for young women: consent. So let's get this out of the way from the get-go. Consent isn't just about saying yes or no. It's really much deeper than that. It's about autonomy, boundaries, respect, and education, all of which impact young women in ways society often ignores. From the legal system to personal relationships, there are still huge gaps in understanding, protection, and awareness when it comes to consent. So I'm joined at the table today for the final episode of season 3. We have the season finale today. I'm joined here by three incredible guests. We have Emma Ajous, who is appearing on the show for the second time round. She was previously on Young Women and Mental Health on season 1. She's a multidisciplinary artist whose practice is deeply rooted in personal experience, using art to explore trauma, memory, and healing. She is also an activist and a survivor of sexual abuse. Antonella Bugeia, also her second time on my show. She was previously on Young Women and Harassment. She's an artist, medical student, and neuroscience graduate, passionate about mental health and sexual health. And finally, we've got Mel McElhattan, who is a psychotherapist, social worker, well-being consultant, and a PhD student, whose work is mainly focused on gender, sexuality, and neurodiversity. Ladies, thank you all so much for joining me here today and for bringing your voices to such an important discussion. I really do believe that this conversation needs to be happening right now. So I've already kind of introduced you a little bit, but I want to give you the opportunity to also introduce yourselves. Mel, could you start us off?
Okay, I'll start. I think you gave me a really great intro, to be fair. But basically, I'm Mel. This is my voice. Hi, if that helps. So as Sasha said, I'm a psychotherapist and social worker. I am very passionate about helping people. I know it sounds like a cliche, but I love working with young women, older women as well, all genders technically, but we're talking about women today. And my specialties are more related to gender, sexuality, and neurodiversity, which is why then the topic of consent is very interesting, because we do talk a lot about consent in heterosexual relationships, not just, and we don't always include the other genders that can experience issues with consent, or even knowing how to ask for consent or how to react to it, and also the neurodiversity angle, because not everyone asks for consent in the same way. I've worked with a lot of people who, because of lack of information about consent and the repercussions and coercion, or even very indirect coercion that can happen, they have suffered because of that. So I'm really glad that the show is happening, especially for young women, because it's never too early to learn about consent and definitely never too late. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Definitely. And thank you for being here. Thank you for accepting my invitation. Antonella, you want to tell us a bit about yourself?
So, hi, I'm Antonella. I agree a lot with what Mel has said. And for me, I've done my master's in the neural activity of sexual arousal. And in the last 5 years, I've been an activist in terms of mental health and sexual health. So through my studies and working with different minorities and different groups, I've learned a lot more about the field and what's needed, and kind of received a lot of support and understood more on how to support other people. And I'm also a sex educator, and I see the importance of the topic of consent a lot, especially when giving trainings and workshops. It's a very, very complicated topic, as you've both introduced as well. And it's something that needs to be talked about a lot, especially because the complexity can make it really confusing for someone to understand, both when it comes to understanding how you need to give consent, also understanding how to see if the partner you are with or the person you're with is properly giving consent. So yeah, it's a difficult, complex topic, but I'm really excited to explore it with you guys.
Same here. I think the fact that we keep saying how complex it is makes it like proves the point of how much it's needed, because it's difficult to navigate it as well in real life. You know, when we are faced with real life situations, how are we going to react? So yeah, Emma.
Hi, I'm Emma.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's so great to be here once again. Well, I'm here to tell my story. I'm here to retell my story, to continue telling, to continue repeating it, because hashtag shutting up is not okay. I am an activist with art. I'm currently preparing for a solo exhibition, which is amazing. It's about my journey through where the rape got me to where I am. Who I am becoming. So I am really excited to share that with the world once the time comes.
That's so exciting. I want to mention, when you came on the mental health show, you had already spoken about your experience. But now that we're talking about it again, there have been developments within the case, within as well as you. The fact that you kind of said yourself, like, who I've become from this experience.
Exactly.
I'm just so happy to have you back here so that we continue telling the story and bringing about the change that is needed, both on a societal level and also when it comes to the justice system.
Exactly.
So, thank you all for being here once again. So before we get into our conversation, I want to set the tone with some statistics. One of which baffled me when I was attending the content creator seminar a few weeks ago in Brussels. In the EU, only 0.5% of rapes lead to conviction, meaning that even when women speak out, justice is rarely served. 49% of women regret their last casual sex encounter. This is a statistic I learned in just a few moments ago from Mel. I just had to include it because how reflective is that? One in three women worldwide experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. In 2022, 79% of recorded victims of intimate partner violence were women, and 69% of victims of domestic violence were also women. A 2023 survey found that only 50% of young women felt they fully understood what consent in sexual situations actually means. In the EU, only 12 out of 27 countries legally define rape based on lack of consent, and Malta still does not. So, do you have any reactions to these statistics? Maybe there's something you want to comment on. I mean, they're shocking, but they highlight just how much work needs to be done, not just legally, but socially, right?
Honestly, yes, and psychologically, because it is horrifying to hear that, for example, 0.5% of rape are convicted. Essentially. So what does that tell people? Don't bother reporting, because you're just getting re-traumatized every single time. And part of what they don't tell you about these convictions is that it does you harm actually to seek help, psychological help, before you go for a conviction, before you report someone, because then they'll think that the judge or the lawyers can twist it then, mm-hmm. that, oh, you sought help and maybe the psychologist put it in your brain that you were sexually abused. You weren't actually sexually abused. And these were things, cases that happened not in Malta, but abroad. And it just highlights the fact that women are generally not believed. And if they are believed, then there's always an excuse given of, it was your fault though, or what did you do? And you said something about 50% of women, young women, don't understand what consent is. That is shocking. That mm-hmm. is terrifying, because if I don't understand what it is, how can I understand how to give it? And how can I understand how to check that the other person is understanding what I mean by consent and I don't mean? Mm-hmm. Also, I'd be curious to see how many young men understand what consent is and what they rely on. I saw a study. I like to read studies for the fun of it, because why not? I am a PhD student, but the study had nothing to do with my research itself. It's fine. And what the research had done a few years ago was actually go around schools in the UK and speak to young boys and young girls about consent, sexual relationships, what do they understand, what don't they understand. And a lot of pressure is being put on young people with nonverbal cues. You're asking for consent in a nonverbal way, never much in a verbal one. But that creates a little bit of a catch-22 for young women then, because unfortunately, women are still slut-shamed. They still have to keep a facade of, I am a woman of integrity, and a woman of integrity does not have sex. Ultimately, you only have sex when you're married and only to have children, somehow. Which means then that you have the initiator and the gateway keeper. Statistically, then, the man is the initiator, the female is the gateway keeper, the gatekeeper, for lack of a better word. And in the mind of these boys and girls, the gatekeeper was the inferior one. The initiator is the powerful aggressor moving towards the sexual act. Some boys did actually feel that the gatekeeper is more powerful purely because she can say no to sex and they have to obey. In fact, it found that boys don't intend to be problematic. They don't intend to hurt women, but they're also easy to downplay it. That, oh, we didn't know, or the terms, you know, falling into the trap of I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Part of it is the norm nonverbal cues that we're relying on. So going back a bit about the women who don't want to be slut-shamed, that then that means that we rely on the fact that we have to say no when we mean yes, but also we can't be very enthusiastic with our yes, otherwise, oh, you want it too much. And that creates a very confusing dynamic for you. It's kind of like when you go to Nanna's house and Nanna wants to make you soup. And you're like, Nan, it's okay, it's okay, don't stay taking bowls out, don't make me a coffee. You say it once, you say it twice, and then finally you say, okay, Nan, thank you very much. And we think sexual relationships are the exact same way. We say no, until finally you say yes. And we don't see it as coercion because we do it with Nanna, we do it with our parents, we do it with our cousins, we do it with our friends.
Yeah, it's like when someone asks you so many times, you're so tired of saying no, that then at some point you're like, okay.
Exactly.
Yes.
But it's almost a protocol at this point. You want Nanna's soup, you do want Nanna's coffee, but you do have to say no first, otherwise you're too greedy. Madonna, you came to eat at my place. Yes. So you have to say no, you have to say no. So both from a genuine standpoint, you don't know. You think it's just part of the usual protocol of no, no, yes. But then yes, as you said, Sash, it can become coercive then of I'm just tired of saying no, so I might as well say yes. Mm-hmm. And that is horrifying.
And I feel that at least like from women that I know, from my experiences, I'm sure there was at some point in my life where I just said no so many times that then it's like, you know, you're kind of feeling like an inconvenience at that point. And this is what we need to dive into today, like how to remain kind of steady, grounded in your decision, how to communicate this.
Life is never plain sailing, but your period is one challenge that shouldn't ever stop you or stand in your way. Tampax is the number one combination for comfort, protection, and discretion. Tampax tampons are independently tested so you can be certain that there's no harmful substances present. Tampax adapts to your unique body shape to provide you protection even when you're living life to the full, because nothing should stop you, period.
So let's start with the basics. Like, I want to iron this out like from the beginning of the show. What is consent? So many people think that it's a simple yes or no, but it's so much more than that, as we have already shown in just a few minutes. And it needs to be continual. It's a constant process. It's not just a one-time thing. You don't give consent once and then it's like consent for the rest of your life. So if you look at a dictionary, consent is typically defined as two parties having given permission or reached an agreement for something to happen. And Mel, I want to turn to you here again. From a psychologist's standpoint, how would you define consent in a way that's clear and empowering for young women? And Antonella, feel free to jump in as well, because you do also give sex education. So, define it.
We have the hardest job, because it is impossible or very, very difficult to define consent that is continuous in a way that is properly understood. Because like you said properly, it is not just yes or no. It goes beyond that. There's a body autonomy impact. There's a respect aspect to it. There's nonverbal cues. There's verbal cues. We were talking before, Antonella and I, and we were saying, okay, if someone tells me yes, but they look low, they're hiding their bodies, they're trying to shy away from me, is that actually a yes? Do I go ahead with the activity I was suggesting? Even if it's just, can I give you a hug? And I'm just hiding myself away. Yes, yes, you can give me a hug. Is that a yes?
Really,
exactly. Yeah. You're going to be like, oh yeah, you told me yes. Legally speaking, you gave me a yes. You consented. So I can give you the hug. It doesn't make sense that way. And also, if I say yes to something today, I could change my mind at any moment, and my consent is therefore retracted, which can frustrate people, but we need to be okay with that. We have to be okay with frustrating the other person, mm-hmm. because that goes down to respect. It's as simple as I offer to pick you up from your place. I realize that there's too much traffic and I text you, I'm not going to pick you up. I therefore retracted what I said initially. Sure, you're going to be frustrated. You were hoping that I'd pick you up. Now you have to get the bus, but you accept it. Same thing with a sexual relationship. First, I consent to something and then I can retract at any point. Also, the fact that I consented to this right now doesn't mean tomorrow I'm going to consent to the exact same thing. Even though, but yesterday you said yes. Yesterday we had fun. Yeah, but today I don't want to. Today I don't feel like it. Yeah. And that's okay. So I don't know if I can summarize all that into a beautiful phrase, but essentially that's how I would do it. I don't know, Antonella, if you have something to add on.
Yeah, I agree a lot. And I think when it comes to consent, the context is just significantly important, because as well as what you were saying, sometimes you say no so much that eventually you give up. And especially for people who have already experienced sexual abuse in the past, especially childhood sexual abuse, it becomes harder to say no sometimes because there is a freeze response. And that is something that we cannot ignore, because sometimes, even in the context, if you do not feel safe to say no, if you think that the person is going to hurt you or has hurt you in the past, so now you can't get yourself to say no, is that really consent if you're scared for your life at that point mm-hmm. in time? And I think the idea that rape or sexual abuse is always done in an extremely violent nature can also kind of confuse people, because yes, some rape is violent, but a lot of rape is not overtly violent. It can be subtle coercion. It can be in different contexts. It can be in a long-term relationship as well with your partner when you really don't feel like it. You've said no, but then they keep kind of suggesting it and you feel obliged because they're your partner. So there are various aspects of situations where consent is not really respected and they're not talked about enough. And as you mentioned as well with body autonomy, like, I really agree that it's never too early to start discussing this with kids. And sometimes parents are afraid of that because you cannot discuss sex with my 5-year-old kid. You don't have to discuss sex to teach about consent, because the issues, the underlying issues with consent, a lot of the time is a lack of respect to yourself and to other people. And by teaching body autonomy, by teaching about how you can be more in tune with your emotions, how you can understand when you feel uncomfortable and then communicate that and voice that with other people, how you can see if someone's invading your space, and the fact that, okay, it is okay for me to tell that person, I don't want this right now. So that is also teaching about consent. You can teach about consent without ever even mentioning the word or mentioning sex or anything, because mm-hmm. these are things and skills that we need, not just in sexual situations, but in any exactly. situation mm-hmm. that are never really discussed, never talked about. We're taught to, you know, kind of dumb it down. We're taught to comply with people, with what others want. We're taught to be there for men's pleasure. And we're not taught to be there for ourselves sometimes. And that's really crucial. So when it comes to consent, it's so complex. And we need to approach it from a variety of ways. You know, it's not just an enthusiastic yes. It is so much more than that. The nonverbals are so, so important, because the words are as well. And anytime there is a no, it should be respected. But the entire context, the nonverbals, the way that person is speaking to you without speaking to you mm-hmm. is just as important. And I think if we just kind of simplify it to a yes or a no, we would be ignoring a lot of other things that come into play that also need to be in the discussion, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I just do want to highlight as well, like you said, consent is not just for sexual relationships.
Exactly.
It is all
exactly.
the time, every time, because that's how yeah. we practice, that's how we train, yeah, exactly. and how we expect people to respect it. Mm-hmm. What I had said about the children thing before mm-hmm. was, what parents are doing now, and I think it's amazing, is actually asking their kid, do you want a hug? Simple. You can do that with a 2-year-old. It's nothing special. Mm-hmm. And the 2-year-old gets the right to say no or yes, or to change their mind. I went over to a friend's place and she asked her kid, before I was leaving, do you want to give Mel a hug before they leave? And the kid was like, no, at first. And then at the end, he just ran up to me and hugged me anyway.
Yeah.
But he knew that it was no one's forcing him. I wasn't going to go over to him and hug him. Yeah. His mom wasn't going to be mad at him because he didn't want to hug me. Mm-hmm. It just starts from that age. It is so beautiful to see. So if a kid can do it at the age of 2 and be respected, what the hell is happening?
Yeah, because in reality, sexuality is one of the most intimate and vulnerable parts of yourself. So automatically, giving consent and saying no or yes, whatever, is going to be even harder in that context. So if you don't even feel safe to properly say a yes or to be yourself or to understand when you're uncomfortable in any other life situation, then it's going to be a billion times harder for you to do that in a sexual situation. And the same the other way around. If there is someone who has been used their whole life to just always expecting a yes, to just get whatever they want to get, regardless if the other person is saying no, then they're gonna just keep doing the same in a sexual relation. So, you know, it's something to practice in everyday life, not just sex. So.
For sure.
Yeah. I really like what you mentioned about the children as well, because it's powerful to educate the adults and men as well, because we cannot have this conversation without also addressing men to a certain extent. But starting from children, that's really just paving the way, right? And when we were discussing before we started filming, I also brought up the example of consent, for example, within the setting of a yoga class. So for example, when I'm teaching yoga, I don't hug my students unless, like, you know, there is either the non-verbal cues or else I offer a hug, like, do you want a hug?
They're
like, yes. But also something that comes up a lot in the yoga community is teachers who touch their students without asking before. So I have my own policy, like, I do not touch my students, but if someone would like me to assist in an adjustment, they can feel free to ask that, but it is not a given. So I definitely agree, like, consent can be practiced in a multitude of situations that aren't sexual or intimate in that way. So Emma, I want to turn to you now. So I already mentioned, like, I wanted you back on the show particularly because of the advancements that you had, developments that you had in your case. A magistrate who was a female, by the way, she ruled against you, saying that this was not a case of rape because consent was given. So for those who are watching who are not familiar with your case, I want to invite you to walk us through your story, and also, like, to touch upon, like, why this conversation is so important right now within this context.
So I met with my rapist when I was back in Mount Carmel Hospital, and after I was discharged, he sent me a friend request, and I accepted out of naivety, out of expecting nothing, obviously. It's just a friend request. And he was checking up on me regularly because I was self-harming at the time. So he wanted to check up on how I'm doing, how I'm feeling. And so far, so good. Then eventually he asked me for my address. And my first reaction was, Esma, this is a trap. You're putting me under a trap. And he was like, but this is what I do. I help people. Instead of thanking me for jumping to help you, you're refusing my help. And then the day after, the next day, he asked me for my address again. And out of guilt, I gave it to him. And then came the day where he came to my house, and he came to heal, to clean my wounds. And after cleaning my wounds, I was in a very bad shape. It all came into realization that I just let this man in, and he is here, he is helping me because I am so, am I so disabled to not be able to take care of myself that I need him right now at this hour, and he is here touching my legs, healing my, cleaning my wounds. And I started crying. I was in a bad shape. And he took this opportunity to be nice to me. And I rejected. And he still put my head on his chest. And eventually then he took me to my bed. Now I see the red flags. I see them, yes.
But you took advantage of your vulnerable state,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
You are someone of trust, supposed.
Yes. Exactly, like...
There's such a big power dynamic there, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's something that people don't talk about. Like, even the fact that you said, like, but I'm, this is what I do, I help people. In your head, you automatically think, okay, this person can do anything wrong to me because he helps people. And we see this even in cases like with the European Union, big institutions where you have people who are people of authority who you think you can trust, and they take advantage of that authority. And then it creates even more of a confusing state because there's a big power imbalance. There's, you know, society teaches you that these are people you can trust. So there's so many added complexities there. And it's harder, like, I admire you for coming out with it, because it's harder when it's someone who has a certain level of authority over you. It creates that extra barrier of how am I going to be able to speak out when mm-hmm. this person can, mm-hmm. you know, destroy me or so on. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And after they gave me to my bed, he demanded that I undress my shirt because I was still wearing my work shirt. And I refused. I said, no, I don't want to. But he was like, but you have to. You've been wearing this shirt all day. So he went to my bathroom and he got my PJ. And he took off my shirt and he took off my bra. And he helped me to wear the PJ, my shirt. And okay, internally I was screaming, but nothing came out. Nothing came out. And I was so tired. I was so... that feeling. Mm-hmm. Then he turned off the lights and I was like, okay, he's gonna make his way out. But no, he came to my bed and he went inside my bed and I just froze. I said, okay, this is not happening. I'm just going to sleep. And I slept. And in the early hours of the day, of the next day, I feel him touching me, and he put his junk in my mouth, and I was still trying to keep myself from not opening my eyes. Just so that I can act out that I'm still sleeping, because he's a huge man. He is a huge man. He's bigger than me. How else am I going to defend myself? So I froze, and he then eventually raped me. He went on top of me and he raped me, in simple terms. And then I opened my eyes because I was like, okay, this can't go any further. I couldn't scream because there was no one at home, so who else was going to hear me? If I fought for my life, what was I going to do? I'm in my house. I'm in my safe place. What else am I supposed to do? So I genuinely froze. But then I stood there, staring at him on top of me, still on top of me. And he was like, he was so kind. He was like, Emma, it's okay. Nothing is happening. Just go back to sleep. And I started shaking. I started shaking uncontrollably. And he was worried. He got worried. It felt like I was having a seizure. And he got off of me and he was like, stop shaking, stop shaking, stop shaking, stop shaking. Eventually, after a while, I stopped shaking. I pretended that I went back to sleep. And he went and smoked a cigarette. And he went to my kitchen and he ate green beans. Random, I know. And then I hear him going through my drawers, my kitchen drawers. And believe me when I say this, I was terrified that I was living my last minutes of my life. Because in my drawers, there's my knife set. So he was going to get one knife and kill me. Because why else would he want me to stay alive? But he knew too well. He knew too well what was going to happen and how the system works and the rape culture that we live in. That no, he didn't kill me. I'm still here. And sometimes I wish that he did kill me, because maybe then the magistrate would have ruled that there was abuse, that there was actual rape. But here we are. I'm still fighting. I am. I went to court now. I appealed my sentence against what the magistrate ruled, that there was consent and that there was no abuse, because when I told him to leave, he left. After raping me, mind you, after raping me, and when I thought that he was going to rape me once again, when he went back into my bedroom, I slowly asked him kindly, like, I went up on my bed and I went out of my bed and I was like, okay, Emma, you can do this. Kick him off. Kick him out now. And I was like, okay, can you go out, please? Can you go out, please? And I kept repeating. And he was like, now you want me out? And I was like, can you please go out? And he left. And that's why the magistrate ruled that there was consent. I froze. He was in my bed. He used my vulnerability against me. And he's a huge man. He's a fat man. I couldn't have fought back. And this is consent in Malta. This is what consent looks like. And here we are having this conversation, trying to give courage to other women to speak up, but then there is this reckless system that that is doing otherwise, that is not safeguarding us, the victims, the survivors. And we have to go to court and we have to we have to show that we are the victims, that we constantly Isma, but he abused me. He put me through this, and he did this stuff to me. And now I had to go back to Mount Carmel because of the PTSD. I wanted to kill myself because of the PTSD that he put me through. And here we are. This is consent.
I have tears in my eyes right now.
Same. I went to like a roller coaster, so I can't even imagine, because I just went from sadness to intense anger to a lot of sadness at the same time.
Yes, thank you for sharing.
Okay, I need a minute. So I'm about to ruin my makeup right now.
Give me your hand.
I'm sorry, but it's like... sorry. It was just so moving, like hearing you... I don't know how many times, like, I've written about your story and had you on the show as well already, but it's like every time it's like a reminder of how like we're failing women, like the system is failing women. Yeah, do you have any reactions? Like, do you have, I mean, the fact that it's a mental health worker. This is someone that she trusted. This is someone who took care of her within the setting of Mount Carmel. He was removed from his position, right?
He was suspended, but then I don't know what happened. So for all I know, he's still there.
if he still has his job title wherever he is, it's a problem. Yeah. Because ultimately, what's really hurt about this case is the fact that how can you say that consent was given when there is such a power dynamic?
I know.
It is like saying a student with a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know that that cannot be consensual, right? We have established this over the years.
Yes.
A therapist with a client. We have ethics that we have to follow. I cannot actually date a client, obviously, because there's a power dynamic.
Yeah.
So how can I accept a mental health worker consensually getting, let's say, getting consent for an act with someone who was in my care 24, 48 hours, however long before? This doesn't make sense. Even if you actually said, yes, Mela, come on in, Eya, you can't consent. You can't, because that's a different power dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I'm so sorry that for me, such an obvious case still has to get appealed.
Yes, it's crazy. I mean, it's ridiculous. Insane. Literally ridiculous.
And it's stupid because what court does to you, to your mind, to your mental health, is insane. That you have to keep repeating. You have to go through the hearings. You have to, and we haven't even started yet. So we're still in the very beginning stages. And yet, last Monday, I got a taste there of what court was going to feel like. And I'm not okay. I'm not okay with it. And I understand why women don't speak up and they don't go to court or continue going to court. I'm really so sorry that we have to go through this. And then there's a comment, there's no rape culture.
Yeah.
There is no rape culture, but you let him in. But you look too happy that to have been raped. Like there is a face for being raped. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Yes, I crumbled. I wanted to die. I overdosed. Whatever else. So what?
But you are here now. Like,
yes, exactly.
So glad you are here now because like you deserve to be here and you definitely did not deserve what happened to you. And you also deserve like better treatment from the justice system. And I want to focus on one point that you've brought up. It's the act of freezing.
Mm-hmm.
This is also overlooked in Malta's courts. The fact that a victim can have a response, which isn't like fighting and yelling and stuff like that. It is you freeze.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common. And I want to turn to you like, as a psychologist, to tell us more about it, about the freeze response.
For sure. So essentially, we all have different responses that we go through. We sometimes have different responses to different situations. So we don't always freeze in every situation. But essentially, we're talking about fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Fawn is also part of what we should talk about, consent. Because it's the puppy dog eyes of, I will do what you want me to do as long as you don't hurt me. So we also fawn. And it's something very common that we do. But then there's obviously the freeze, because if I know that fighting back might result in being murdered, for example, it might result in more injury, just close my eyes, get this over and done with, and then let's hope for the best after. It is a self-protection mechanism that somehow is used against you. Ironically, the fight response can also work against you, because if you're fighting back against your abuser and they have injuries on them, they can accuse you of violence on them.
And it's self-defense.
And it's self-defense. And it is something we do, and it is something that is used in court.
Yeah.
So which response is allowed now? What are we allowed to do? Flight? How can you run away? It's your home.
When someone's on top of you, how can you run?
Exactly.
And in your case, it's in your home as well. And,
exactly.
And I think it's the freeze response is so relevant, not just when there is violence, but especially when, like, even so, when, for example, there's a long history of sexual abuse or rape, or even if it's just one history of it, sometimes when you're in that situation again, you kind of freeze and go back to the state that you are in that moment. I mean, already after you were assaulted or raped, like sometimes it's very difficult to go back to a healthy sex life, to even have sex with someone you trust, let alone if you are put again in an involuntary sexual experience. You just freeze, you go back to a state you were when you were younger and it was happening. And so that is something that really needs to be taken into consideration as well. Because the thing is, everything that we've been talking about, this lack of education, this lack of awareness of kind of the issues with consent, even this power dynamic, like to us, it's obvious that the moment there is a power dynamic, it is not consensual. But then getting the response from the magistrate, for example, will just confuse you. So this lack of clarity on everything surrounding consent will make things even more confusing, because then you start doubting yourself. But is my emotion valid? Was this actually rape or assault, or was this not? And in fact, like, I've kind of dealt with the system quite a lot in the past as well. And yeah, not a lot of positive experiences. But I always tell friends who talk to me about these things, like, obviously reporting will help, but only do it if you're comfortable, because the system destroys you. Like, the system will re-traumatize you. And even if we had the ideal system, okay, which we definitely do not.
Very far.
Very, very far from it. Even if it was an ideal system, just the fact that you have to tell your story to strangers, mm-hmm. it's difficult talking about it to friends, let alone to a stranger who you do not know if they're there to help you or not. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that you've been traumatized by the experience, but the journey afterwards and mm-hmm. tuning into yourself again after what happened, being okay with, like, sexuality with other people, but also with yourself, like that feeling of your body isn't even yours anymore, you know? For example, for me, photography was something that really helped me with that, because due to my past experiences, for the longest time until today even, I sometimes just feel like my body is not mine. It is this, like, mask of people's unwanted touch, you know, like it there's just this element of disgust, this element of it's been used and I don't want it anymore. So things like photography really helped me tune back into my body and realize, no, it is my body. I do have control over it, and it can be a means of expression, of art. It's there not to look beautiful or to be used for pleasure or whatever, but it's there to help me live and to go on adventures and do whatever it is, you know. So I think it's just a very complicated thing, and the freeze response is definitely something that really, really needs to be talked about. Because I, like, realistically, how can you be okay with having sex with a barely conscious person?
Yeah,
like, if you stop moving, how is that sex? Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, but if you think that is sex for you, then I don't think you're having the right sex. Like, to be frank, like, come on.
Give me some sex ed.
Yeah, you like, contact me for a sex ed, but come on, seriously. For sure, like, sex is meant to be pleasurable for both people. There's meant to be movement from both people. So if a person is sleeping, if a person is drunk that they're blacked out, then how can that be consent, you know? And it doesn't matter if you are actually asleep or pretending to be asleep. You are not reacting. You are not alert and conscious for that person. So how, like, these things are just insane. And the fact that even, it's not just that we're not properly educated on what consent is, the fact that in Malta, the legality of it, the legal mm-hmm. definitions of mm-hmm. it are also messed up, mm-hmm. doesn't help. Because if it's not even legally properly defined, mm-hmm. how are you even going to start?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Like, yeah. I really appreciate what you said about the way you used photography as a way to kind of, like, reclaim your power over your own body. And I know this art was a big thing for you in your healing journey. I'm wondering if you want to share something about it.
Yes. I love symbolism, and I love metaphors, and I love the poetic part. And I romanticized a bit the rape for the sake of me getting through it, and how that's how it helped me. But then again, I put all my anger into art, and I drew him as the black horse and the unicorn, the innocent unicorn that now has his horn as his dick, and the shattered innocence that he put me through, that for God's sake, I God forbid that he might be doing to someone else. as well, because he's still free, he's still living his life, and I am only one person, and I can fight so much, but at the same time, I have to help myself. And if he is raping other women, then it's all up to the courts, and it's all on them, it's all on the magistrates. And I put all this anger into my heart, and I drew him as a pig. I drew him as his fat, shaved man that he is. And eventually I'm passing through a transition that I don't necessarily need to draw the actual rape, but drawing the rape is like, okay, this actually happened. People are trying to minimize, to shut me down, but I know my truth. I know that this happened and my body is reacting to it. So if you're gonna shut me up, you're not. If you think that you're gonna, you're not.
Love it. Bravo.
Yeah. And I also see a contrast in you, like from the first show you were on to now, the way you're talking about it. I mean, your smile, you're just... moving on to navigating consent, like in the real world, we touched upon it a bit in the beginning. So one of the biggest issues with consent is that many young women don't feel empowered to say no, or don't recognize when their consent is being ignored. So how do you think we can shift the conversation so young women can feel more confident in asserting their boundaries?
I think part of it is to be aware of your internal pressure as well. Sort of what messages have you been receiving growing up that might be influencing the decision you're taking right now? Unfortunately, a lot of messages, to go back to relationships specifically, the messages we receive are, if you're not having sex with your partner, someone else will be. So it is your fault if they are cheating on you.
Yep.
So it's your fault.
Yeah.
It's always your fault. It's always so easy to find a reason why someone else's bad behavior is on you. It is incredible how our minds go through these trips and tricks and BMX style stuff. Like, I can't even imagine it, the mental loops that we do. Mm-hmm. But it's so easy to do it. So if growing up, I'm hearing the message of, if someone cheats, were you having sex with him though? You have to, I mean, everyone's going to have a roaming eye at some point. Like, it's, so then what do you do? How often then am I actually having sex with my partner because I've already said no 3 times this week? Mm. I'm nervous that they are going to hate me, they're going to be upset at me, or that they might go have sex with someone else, because realistically, it's impossible to survive weeks on end without sex, as if. So understanding that internal pressure that might be influencing your yes, it's also a lack of consent, actually. So therefore, sometimes we have to also include in the conversation the other person, for example, the man in this case, to actually tell, are you sure she's actually saying yes? Yeah. Are you sure her body language is saying that? Are you sure that you didn't ask too many times at this point? Are you giving responsibility to her to be the initiator sometimes? And that's so powerful. Let women be the initiator sometimes. It is sexy. It is powerful. It is empowering. It's amazing. So that is such an easy shift we can do. So hello, guys, relationship advice. Let the woman be the initiator. It would be amazing to watch. And I feel like the woman will flourish in that aspect. But that's only talking about the internal pressure that we sometimes feel to say yes when we don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think also important to mention, I mean, as you know as well, that when you work in therapy, but the fact that these things happen no matter the gender as well, like, yes, it happens a lot more from when it's like a man with a woman, but even, because then it gets confusing, for example, even in lesbian relationships, you get confused, because if you're receiving these signals or these violent situations or so on from another woman, you kind of, like, your brain glitches a bit, because it's like, what's going on? How can this be happening? No, is it just overly nice and I'm just interpreting it weirdly? Like, it continues adding a bit to the confusion. And also, I think the lack of external support as well, the lack of the internal biases, the internal pressure and so on. But for example, in cases with universities and stuff like that, the system to report these things is so lacking that it's difficult. Like, mm-hmm. if there is no safe way to report, even when it's not reporting to the police, but to the institution that you are in, where do you even start from? You know, exactly. And that is a struggle on its own. Like, even when it comes to, for example, support groups, we need more of these things, because the reality is, this is something that, I was talking about with my friend, actually, and we talk about our experiences a lot together. And once she said, like, survivors, we kind of speak the same language. And I agree with that. Once I was in a discussion and we were a group of people, and eventually the conversation took a turn on this topic. And it was me and three other people that were talking about our experiences with sexual abuse and so on. And we were, from all four of us, from completely different age groups, different sexualities, different gender identities. And I'm talking differences in age groups like 20 and 60, okay? And yet, every single symptom each one of us experienced, every single traumatic thought, emotion, like process, we were all nodding, all agreeing, and we felt so seen and like we could relate to each other. And it was that reminder of, it's true, you start speaking the same language, you experience certain things that might be difficult to explain to other people, but a person who's been through it will know without you even needing to say it. And like the fact that there was so much diversity there, because I think in society there is an image of what rape or sexual abuse is, and the moment it strays away from that image a bit, you get confused and you question it even more. But to me, the fact that there was so much diversity there shows that no, it's not just one way. It happens in a lot of different contexts and it has the same effect. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something else that can help, kind of changing the narrative, showing the different ways that lack of consent can be expressed in. So showing the different ways that these things can happen, because that will empower women to realize, this situation was not okay, mm-hmm. you know, and I do have the right to speak up about it, to seek for help, because there is also the concept of trauma imposter syndrome, which is a really big, difficult thing. That feeling of, I didn't suffer enough to get the support I need. Hers was rape, but mine was not. Mm-hmm. Like, this thing continues adding to the shame, because it's not only that you've been through a traumatic situation that you probably don't even fully understand how much it impacted you now, but then you're also feeling shame or guilt over, am I taking up the space from someone who needs it more than me? Do I deserve this help? Do I deserve to relate to this person? Was this actually it? So it just continues adding, and it just, it's a difficult thing. You have all the internal pressure. You have the internal struggles, and then externally, the support is not there. Mm-hmm. And we need that support. And I really like something that you said right in the beginning, which is that it's never too early, but it's also never too late. Because we hear it's never too early a lot, but we don't really hear it's never too late. And it's true. If we have 20-year-old women, people in general, if we have 60-year-old people that are not, like, are still not aware of what consent is and what mm-hmm. rights they have and how these things happen, let's educate them as well. Let's have mm-hmm. healthy conversations, because it is never too late to realize what you deserve and what's okay and what's not, and to change your own narrative, you know, and to help get out of a situation. So
mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for saying that.
Copyrighted 2025.
Yes.
I'm speechless. Like, there, you're ticking all the boxes that I haven't heard in a while, and that really need to be spoken. And I'm like, yes, yes, yes. They're mentioning that. They're mentioning that. Yes. And so I'm really enjoying both of you talking about it, and you're mentioning it from all different aspects. That yes. Yes, I'm so glad that I'm here.
So I'm going to ask all of you, what do you think is like the biggest misconception when it comes to consent that young women are facing today?
Because I'm thinking, linked with sort of the topic, that consent is overrated and it's extra. In fact, I imagine that some people might see the title of the show, Young Women and Consent, and be like, why do we need to be talking about consent? Which obvious? Isn't it obvious? Like, yes, yes, no, no.
It's overlooked, eh, often.
It's overlooked. And that's such a misconception because it is incredibly important. It is necessary to have these conversations, these actions, to show the people around you it with actions that you are a safe person for them as well. Because when you were talking about those external factors that you can't, the trauma imposter syndrome, can I talk to my friends then that I went to Portugal and someone groped me because I know that other friend got raped? It's like, you still deserve to have space, but do we let people have space? Are we safe people for them? So definitely one of the misconceptions is that it is not important to highlight consent.
I think for me, it's kind of similar to what we've been talking about a lot, but to not overlook the complexity of it, to really give importance to the non-verbals as well, you know, because the verbals are very important, but you really cannot ignore the non-verbals. And sometimes people say we're taking, kind of as you were saying as well, like the we're giving too much importance to consent nowadays. And the thing is, the way you express your consent can vary as well. For example, if you're with a long-term partner, yeah, you're not gonna, every time you kiss or every time you have sex, you're gonna be like, do you wanna have sex? Because, okay, like realistically as well, I've had sex with people and, you know, there were different verbals. Like it's, you learn as you grow to understand body language. Like I think it's really, really important to emphasize that no always means no. Like that is something that never needs to change.
Yeah.
But understanding the nonverbals behind a yes or the nonverbals in general, even when there is no yes given, for example, a long-term relationship or so on, is really important because you cannot separate those two. And you really, like we as women, I think especially, need to support each other and help reduce slut shaming and so on. Because, I mean, at this point, how many times have we all heard, oh, but what were you wearing?
Literally.
Oh, but literally. How many people have you had sex with? What's your body count? And these things, like, and you see it, that I feel sometimes amongst women, there's more slut shaming than when, because
than
we
men
have,
to women, like.
Yeah, like we have so much internalized misogyny that we just keep on
totally
creating it automatically. So, you know, stop asking these questions of what were you wearing, but are you sure? Like when you open up to someone, hearing, are you sure, destroys you. Because in that moment, you've already given so much energy and effort into talking about it and then being met with, are you sure? Just clashes completely. And one thing that happens, I mean, my neuroscience nerd is coming out now. But, you know, our brain, when there are traumatic situations, automatically, in order to kind of keep us going and help us survive, we forget a lot of it consciously, subconsciously, and our body does not forget. But our memory gets really blurry sometimes. So when you're already kind of battling that or like any dissociation you would have had and so on, but you know, like you remember the snippets and you know that, yes, something was very wrong. Again, having other people meet you with a lot of doubt just continues to make it even worse. And I think that is something that really interests me, the effects of memory and trauma imposter syndrome and all of these things. Like it's something that, you know, it's really difficult to tackle, I think, but definitely should be. And just overall, more support. Like we need more support, you know, because, yeah, these things are really shitty, but at least we can understand each other, you know, and the fact that you can have a community. So instead of trying to say, are you sure, trying to find the reasons or causes that we may have contributed to the situation, let's just support each other and be there and know that you're not alone and know that other people are also going through these things, experiencing these symptoms, and there can be a way out. And I think even though it's really difficult, the energy that you put into trying to tune into your body again after such a situation and the connection that eventually you can feel is also, in a weird way rewarding, I guess, because you start, like, you get empowered again. You are so empowered right now to keep on fighting. And yes, that is amazing. Not everyone has that ability, and it's fine because we all deal with situations in a different way. But the fact that you managed to take an experience and turn it into something you can grow through and help others with, I think is beautiful, you know? And yeah, there's... Yeah, I spoke too much. I'm sorry.
No, but seriously, yeah. Apologizing. Take that back. Going, listening to
us. Yeah.
But I also understand, and I want to point out that it's okay if you don't feel safe to not
exactly.
talk.
Exactly.
You have to feel safe. Mm-hmm. If it's not safe, don't put yourself yes. in a dangerous situation. Yeah. In my position, I knew that I had to report instantly. And to continue on with the consent, there is a beautiful allegory of having a lunchbox with a sandwich in it. And someone else wants to take a piece of your sandwich, and they don't just take your mm-hmm. sandwich from your box. They have to ask. They have to go with the consent. So, in this simple term, consent is so easy. Mm-hmm. Like a 2-year-old knows what consent is. Yeah. You don't just assume that someone wants to share the sandwich with you. Mm-hmm. It's putting it into simple terms makes more sense. But then when it comes to the real world, the real humans interaction, suddenly it all becomes complicated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if I, for example, was burglared, someone came and stole, came into my house, we don't blame the people inside the house. Why did you let him in? Mm-hmm. No, I didn't let him in. He broke into my house.
Yeah.
Tipo, but why were you sleeping? Yeah, because that's what I do in my house. I sleep. But it's so ironic that we can't simply understand ABC.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think there's also a similar thing, but with tea. Whole video.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people know it, and obviously more should, but it simplifies it so much. And there is that thing of you don't give tea to someone who's drunk, who's passed out, who's asleep. You don't just go to a sleeping person and you pour the tea on them. You know, that's not how it works. And if someone is like, yeah, I'd like tea, like, today, then you don't just go every single day after, knock on their door, be like, tea, tea, tea. Like, you know, when you think about it in these situations, it sounds hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
And if like someone's like, yeah, I'll have tea, 2 hours pass, and they don't want tea, you're not going to scream at them and be like, but 2 hours ago, you said you'll have tea. Like,
made
what
you
the
perfect
hell
tea. How dare you?
Like, why do you not want tea now? You know, what's wrong with you now?
Actually really glad you brought these examples, because you're making it sound so stupid. Like,
it's
ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. The fact that in the same context, in any other situation, would sound absurd. Exactly. But then, when it comes to sex, everything
is a gray area. It's a gray area.
Sex, yeah, you give the tea when they're asleep. You chug it in there, you know.
They shouldn't have been asleep in the first place. It's their fault.
Yeah. Like, you're laying down on the floor, not really conscious. Yeah, I'll drop the burning tea on you. Yeah, it's fine. Like, it doesn't make sense. So, how, like, why is it so lost in translation then? It's, yeah.
That is perfect. It's perfect. So I want to go back to the legal system, because we've already touched upon it. And like, despite this growing awareness that we can observe, many legal systems, including Malta's, like heavily including Malta's, they still fail survivors. And we have already seen and discussed that today firsthand. So why do you think it's so important that Malta shifts to a consent-based legal definition of rape? Which I want to add, like when I was in Brussels, we met with this one particular MEP, and she spoke about how she was one of the lead negotiators on the consent-based rape legislation, which was actually blocked by a minority in the council. So it actually hasn't materialized, which just goes to show that even on an EU level, you find this kind of like red tape. So it's not just Malta. But yeah, so why do you think that this is so important?
I mean, let's start with the actual definition of what rape constitutes. And obviously, I need help here because I did not study law. But essentially, it is all about being having a carnal connection.
Yeah, I
love that. Because that's
carnal connection.
It almost sounds romantic, which makes no sense. But a carnal connection between two people, which obviously, which involves the sexual organ of another in the vagina, anus, and mouth.
And oral, mouth. Exactly.
But that means I can't use objects, which we know are used for rape as well. Yes. We can't use fingers, even though, because that's not a sexual organ. Mm-hmm. And that leaves a lot of gray area, that the only allowance is the entry of one sexual organ into the body part of another.
Exactly. So I would want to clarify, like if you made an example before, I will use it again now. If you use a cucumber, that is not, that legally, that is not defined as rape. Yes.
Exactly.
That is how Malta is right now.
Yeah. Exactly. Anything. You can put this microphone, you know, up a vagina and that's not rape.
Exactly. Not at all.
And I think there's also the element of violence, right, in
yes.
it. And that's, again, we're excluding a big, big proportion of rape or sexual abuse situations that don't include overt violence. And what happens to all of these? Like, what happens to the trauma and the people who experience these situations, you know? And I lost my train of thought a bit now.
Sorry, but it's like the responsibility to prove that it's a rape, as usual, goes to the victim, not to the aggressor, to prove that it was actually consented. Yeah. And that's ridiculous, because I have to stay proving that I did not want this. I did not want this to happen. But there's no signs of injury because I had a freeze response. How do I know that you actually had a freeze response and you're not just lying to me right now? The idea that that women are always lying about their experiences is horrifying.
Yeah, and I think even this, like, of course, it is difficult physically or so on to confirm that, for example, rape happened. But why do we need physical injury? Like, it needs to be quite aggressive for there to be physical injury that even stays 4 days, for example. Why do we need that level of aggression? Like, that is a thing that is shown a lot in different countries, but especially in Malta. The fact that you said you wish you had that he killed you because then maybe the magistrate would do something about it. And that is not, it really saddens me that you are saying it and that it's not the first time that I heard it or thought of it or so on. And the fact that in general here, like, there needs to be death or something really serious for the conversation to even start, even with mental health. Everyone talks the moment a suicide is mentioned, even though there are so many suicides that are happening that are unreported.
Mm-hmm.
Another conversation. But why does a person need to have committed suicide for a conversation to start? Why will I only get adequate help if I am on the verge of just, you know, like, why do we need to wait for so much violence? And what happens? Like, okay, maybe this person doesn't have a physical injury anymore, but the mental injury, the mental trauma is still there. Like, why are we not considering that, you know? So there are so many issues with this definition. Like, it excludes so many different things and we really need to tackle them.
And the more common things in reality. Yeah. Most rapes are happening by people we know.
Exactly.
So there is that response that happens as well. Rapes are happening with drugs involved. So there's a different response that's happening. Mm-hmm. The idea of the violent rape where there is penetration by a sexual organ is a far less percentage.
Yes.
It is the dramatized thing we see on TV, essentially. The thing that gets us all emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, great, it's media. But media should not regulate, should not create laws either. Laws should be based on what is really happening out there. And we know that what's really happening, but somehow it's not translating in the regulation, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is something that I talk about a lot with my friends as well. Like, we're all taught, don't talk to strangers, be careful when you're walking in the street and so on. And yes, you have to be careful and things can happen in the street or with strangers too. But as you said, most of these situations are happening with people you trust, with friends, with family. Again, people of authority, like in nationwide, European-wide institutions, the amount and percentages of sexual assault and rape and the amount of people that use their, like, their position of power to take advantage is crazy. Yeah. And because these things are not talked about so much, they're forgotten. And even when a person experiences them, it's like you are alert if a stranger is going to do something to you, but you're not alert if a family member, a friend does it, a person you're meant to trust does it. And so it just creates more confusion. And these things need to be, even in media, they need to be talked about. They need to be shown, because you cannot just have a dramatized version of it, because then it adds more confusion and it excludes a lot of people who need help. And
for sure. I was going to say something I forgot, actually. I was like drawn by this. I get so passionate about it as well.
it's a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, and you don't get to a point where we're paranoid about our friends and family members, because that's dangerous as well, because then you're never relaxed, you're never safe. But then it's up to the law to help me feel safe if something happens. It's kind of like with the burglary metaphor, it's perfect, because if I get burgled, I don't expect to be asked, but did you lock the windows? Are you sure you locked the doors? Did you triple lock the doors? Did you buy the good locks for your doors, though? And I want to feel safe in my home. I want to feel like if someone does enter my home, even if it was someone I trusted, many robberies actually do happen from family members or people who know that you're not home. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
That if I go to the police, they won't say, oh, but is it really that person's fault? Because, you know, they have been invited into your home before. They clearly knew where the jewelry was.
Yeah.
But I didn't consent this time for them to come take my jewelry, right? You know?
Yeah.
So we don't want to get to a space where we're paranoid about the people closest to us, because we need to feel safe. Mm-hmm. But then I expect the justice system to protect me, the mental health system to protect me, should anything happen, which we know does.
We've touched upon a bit, like, it's difficult sometimes to report. You said so yourself, like, don't make a report unless you feel that it's safe to do so. And when we're discussing, like, power dynamics, normally it's not safe to do that. Like, for example, when it comes to assault that happens on the place of work, maybe you're not in a position to lose your job. Like, so it complicates the situation a lot. So while people are encouraged to speak, you also have to be mindful of what situation is going to place you in, basically. So for many survivors, the hardest part is speaking out.
Yeah.
They fear judgment, not being believed, or even retaliation. So Emma, what would you say to young women who feel afraid to speak about their experiences? Do you encourage them to speak about them so that they can seek justice for themselves?
They must know what they're going to put themselves into. That's the bare truth. And it's hard for me to say it, because yes, we all want justice, but this will keep reopening your wound. And although it will make you stronger, it will first try to kill you. And you still have to go through that process of going and working on your trauma. But if court is too much, don't go to court, but heal yourself and go to therapy and take care of yourself. Unfortunately, the statistics, the numbers, doesn't mean anything unless it hits you personally. And although that might sound not in tune in what I just said, I think it makes sense, because unfortunately we have to pass through something to know what it feels like to not judge other people unfortunately.
And what would you say if you have something to add on to that?
I 100% agree. I say this to a lot of people that I meet. It's the same thing of the system can really destroy you. So take care of yourself. Like, your number one priority after such experiences is yourself, and make sure that you have the right support. Seek therapy if you need to help you get over the situation, help you be stronger and kind of just cope with the symptoms that you might be experiencing. It's really important to take care of yourself and work on that aspect of healing. And another thing is something that I mentioned in the harassment podcast as well, actually. And it's credits to my sister, who I love a lot. And she had told me this because, as we've been saying, kind of sometimes it's very difficult and we question ourselves a lot and all of these things. And something that she told me that kind of really changed the way I view a lot of my experiences is when you're really questioning something like that, that's kind of, as you said, like deep inside, you know, it's your truth, but society and your internal pressures and biases are making you question it. Just imagine if your little sister, a little like an other person who you really care about, who's younger, told you the exact same things that you are saying. Would you be like, okay, no, and brush it off? Or would you feel angry and frustrated and tell them that it was not their fault and support them and so on? And if you are really questioning your situation, but then when you think about it, if you're telling it to your little sister or my niece, in my case, you know, you realize how fucked up it was, then treat yourself with that same love and respect. You know, you deserve it. If you think about it and anyone else told it to you and you say that is wrong, then why are you questioning it with yourself? You know, give yourself that love. It's really, really important too. So.
That's so powerful. And I feel like you're leading us straight to the kind of closing, the words of wisdom that I always like to ask for. So this conversation really is just the beginning when it comes to this topic. But yeah. I want to ask each of you now, what's the one thing you want every young woman to understand about consent? And what's one thing you believe men need to understand about consent? Because it's useless having these conversations if we're not also addressing men. So what would be your message here?
I'd say to the young woman, to my daughter if I ever have, or to my sister and to my mother and to my friend, I would say trust your gut. But at the same time, don't take it up on you. The abuse that happens to you, because it's never your fault. And to the rapists, I would say, why did you rape? I wouldn't say to the young adult, whoever, don't wear a short dress. I would ask the rapist, why did you rape? And we don't know who they are, because they never get persecuted. So yes, don't rape. Simple.
Yeah. Okay, so for women, I would say to be a safe space for the others around them, to let people tell you things and then be safe and motivating, supportive, encouraging, whatever. I also wanted to quote a little bit from The Handmaid's Tale, classic quote of Nolite de bastardes carbon dorum. I'm sorry to my A-level English teacher if I got that wrong. But essentially, don't let the bastards get you down. You know what you know. You know what you feel. Feel safe to say what you want, what you don't want. And if anyone has a problem with that, that is on them, not on you. But then also for the men, who I know are actually listening to this and watching it, as you should, bravi. It is the idea of you are part of the responsibility to keep the people around you, whoever they are, safe. Whether it is through jokes that you make with your friends, which normalize rape culture as well, which diminish the importance of consent, you are responsible to also educate. Clearly, if you're watching this, you're a good guy. So
yeah,
help others be good guys too.
Yeah.
To the women, I think you both said a lot as well that I relate to. And I'd say, you know, focus on yourself and gaining control over your body again, and never give up on yourself as well. Take care. It's not your responsibility to change the world, you know. There is ways that you can help, but focus on empowering yourself first, because you can't pour from an empty jug at the end of the day. And I'd say, don't be afraid to speak up, not necessarily in a political or police mm-hmm. way, but anyone, even if you trust one person with your story, and explore ways of how you can heal, whether it's drawing, painting, photography, music. There are ways where you can heal, which are not necessarily speaking, if speaking about it is difficult. You can find other artistic methods, even through research sometimes a person can heal, you know. So find your way. And for men, I would say respect. Like, I'd say just really focus on respect, respect for yourself and respect for other people, so that they can really truly understand how to respect other people when it comes to sexual situations or so on. And that can help reduce cases of sexual abuse and rape, but also to respect themselves enough to, you know, want sex, which is actually enthusiastic, you know, mm-hmm. to not have sex with someone who doesn't want to back, you know. You can have sex with someone who actually wants to have sex with you. So enjoy
crazy,
that.
Crazy, right?
Yes, an innovative idea.
Yeah, respect yourself enough to, oh, you know, want sure. that, and not just seek the control and power you feel when you're having sex with someone you view as inferior. And also so that when these situations happen to them, they can also find the courage to speak up with their friends about it, you know, and stop these situations. It goes both ways. So just respect.
Well, really does boil down to respect.
Yeah.
And big respect to all of you here. I mean, thank you for fulfilling my wish to make this conversation a reality, and also, you know, what actually came out of it today. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your courage, for your strength, for your knowledge, your experiences. I really believe that this conversation is crucial, and the more we talk about it, the more we can push for change in schools, in relationships, in law, and in society, in the way that we approach this. So let's keep this conversation going, because every woman deserves to be heard, respected, and seen. Thank you.
Mic drop.